Thank you. Thank you, Steve, for having me here. And Laylee, thank you for sharing this with me. I liken a lot of my life to different films. And you, how many of you have seen, like, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon? Do you know the villain in that movie, the Jade Fox? She steals a manuscript from the Wu-Tang Clan, and she could never master it. Because she just couldn't get there. There was something that she was not able to get there. But when and then she had that student who just picked up the book and just went with it, right? And when I met you and I saw your work, I was having that moment where I'm like, she's doing things with poetry that I could never get to, right? And so thank you for that. I'm going to start by saying that I am writing to be read these days as opposed to be heard. So when I do that, I'm a lot braver. But I'm standing in front of you now, and you're about to hear my words. So I had to write something for myself to remind myself that I can do this. This is a reminder to the you who endeavored to write these words. It is not your job to confront or adjust. You write what you know as a way of living. You write what you know so that someday, one day, you will again write the imagined. This is a reminder to the you who endeavored to read these words. Should you see yourself standing by my side, know that there is room. There will always be room. Should you see yourself inside, that these words, they are not for you, but rather about you. Well then, that is on you. Steve talked about Juan Felipe writing a piece of folks sitting on a bus talking. Sometimes you don't even have to talk to be othered in spaces. And so this is a poem about that. Often it happens when you least expect it. You're on a bus on your way home. A man on this bus is coughing intermittently. He is told by the bus driver to cover up when he is coughing. This goes on for about 15 minutes or so. The man coughs. The driver is insisting he cover his mouth. The man is ignoring the bus driver. Perhaps he is unaware that she is speaking to him. He continues to cough. Someone else on the bus is saying, he's paying you no mind, you should just call the police. And yet another person is saying, he doesn't understand English, he doesn't understand English. The man is being asked by the bus driver to leave. The bus is parked. The driver refuses to continue driving. The man is sitting in the back of this bus. He is coughing. He's spreading germs. He's minding his own business. What is he doing? Why won't he answer? You decide to leave and walk the rest of the way home. As you are walking, you see the police car making its way towards the bus. You look back. You wonder if you should have stayed. If your father was still alive, he would have been about the same age as that man. He would have been coughing on that bus, and you would have told him to cover his mouth. There's an uncomfortable realization that comes with knowing. You want to know that you belong. It happens when you laugh uncomfortably at a joke. It happened in the sixth grade. It happened in college. It's happening now. Your desire to belong overwhelms you with shame. It happens when you least expect it, while taking the bus or walking home. Like I said before, I liken my life to, or I try to insert myself into different films. You imagine yourself as Morgan Freeman, the character of Red in The Shawshank Redemption. It's your third time up for parole while serving a life sentence. The boy who sits across from you, he's actually a man, but he's about half your age. He reads from a script. He asks you, why do you want to be a part of society again? He asks you why you deserve to walk among the free. You want to help tell him to go fuck himself. Free of polite language, you want to tell him to go fuck himself. That you don't really care to walk in his shadow. That he is young and does not know. He does not know that you will raise his children. That you will teach them how to be decent human beings. And that you will it will cost you a part of yourself. You hesitate. You shift a little in your chair. Your hands become clammy in that moment. You have an out-of-body experience. Everything is in slow motion, and you see your lips straining to move. You tell yourself to just fucking do it. You tell yourself that you have nothing to lose. And you realize that you are not in a movie and that you are not in prison. You are not guilty of anything and you are not free. And then you say it. You say it that you've worked hard and that you will continue to work. That this is what you've wanted to do all your life. You say that you see yourself as one of them. You say it. You know that you will never be one of them. You say it like it was a statement written in a book on your behalf long before you were born. You say it again and again and again in the hopes that this committee, who by the way consists of three white people, will believe you. And then you have this epiphany. You've always been judged by some committee of three white people. You have this realization that you have been doing this all wrong. Today, you've learned a valuable lesson. You say that this is a story best told in the second person, and you say to your reader, this is to be continued. You say to your reader, this will be rewritten. You say to your reader, this story will be told in its entirety. When the older white colleague takes you under his wing, gives you advice, he tells you that you should make an effort to translate. He tells you that all young academics should be translating. He brings Vietnamese poets from Vietnam. He brings them to his class to tell them to read poetry. He translates their poetry. He tells them to sing a folk song. He translates their rhythms. He leads by example. His students all translate. It's not about language, that awkward moment when I've been given advice I did not ask for nor want. In my hands, he tells me not to translate. It's only natural. After all, he assumes that English is not my first language. It's in that awkward moment when I have to respond, well, actually, I only write in English. Perhaps one day I'll try my hand at translating, but not before I learn the language, its nuances. It's in that moment, that awkward moment, when I'm reminded that life is lived as a life in translation. I didn't realize I was that angry. So this one, there was Red from Shawshank Redemption. This is John Wick. It's been 8 years since you last wrote a book. You couldn't bear the thought of writing another poem. You erased yourself in the hopes of finding yourself. You reinvented yourself as an artist and a sculptor. You built a box to contain your anger. Your words go from past to present. Your present. You dig a hole in the backyard, you tie it to a rope, you lower it into the earth. You even think of cutting off your tongue. In that irrational moment, you come to your senses. Such an act would be too poetic. You bury it with your metaphors and your meters. You think you are done. You think you are happy. You're minding your own business. And eight years later, you're surfing the net. You're reading a blog when someone says something and you find yourself waking up. It's 3 a.m. You're going through your basement. You're looking for the shovel, a flashlight. You're digging in the dirt. You realize your youth when you're digging this hole. You realize your age as you are digging now. You feel the clank of metal on metal. You dig. You dig, you climb your way back to the surface of things. You open the box, you rummage your way through this box. The blade, the image, the metaphor, the line. You cut yourself on the edge of a blank page. you find it at the bottom of this box beneath the gun, and a smile. It's been there all along. You dust it off. You see your reflection. You write your first line after 8 years in exile. You write your first line, and it begins with you. Perhaps with age you will find a way to write a story about someone, somebody, a story whose only objective is to be happy in a world. Your character is happy, the people are happy, you will call it a poem, print it on paper, and hang it on a wall over public urinal stalls. You learned this from a student long ago. On holiday occasions, you will gather with others in a room. You will read this poem. You will give it as a present. And everyone is happy. Perhaps with age, you will make without wanting. You will hold this object in your hands. It is a satisfying object. Its shape, its touch, its weight in your hands. It is abstracted. It is an object. It is you reinvented. Your consciousness reinvented the world, the way, the wonder of it all. Perhaps you're getting ahead of yourself. You write a sentence or a line still angry as fuck. Perhaps with age in this time, perhaps not in this time. I've often been asked to write blurbs, and the thing about blurbs is you want to write a blurb that honors the work. You don't want to write a blurb that somehow puts yourself on center stage. So I try to write one for a book that I really cared about, and this was the blurb. You read a book that begins as obligation. You owe it to your friend who was once your student. You read it in the hopes of framing its virtues in a few sentences. You read a book in the shape of a key, a door appears, and the weight of this key sits in your hand. You are past the point of obligatory rendering. You are intrigued. You are held by the weight of what's written, uneasy in its image, unwilling in its gaze. You're reading a book made up of words and unwritten words. You describe it as beautiful and want to retract the word in that instance. You weigh the weight of that key in your hand. You thread the hole. You turn the key. You unlock the body. The door swings open. It creaks with history. You unlock the body to find bodies within. You read this book. You describe it as beautiful. You say the light is unbearable, as you bear it all the same. You accept the consequences of your own doing. I work at another university, and sometimes I have conflicts in schedule, and this was something that happened at the other university, and I had that moment, I kind of understood how my father existed. What begins as a simple conflict of scheduling turns into an inadvertent struggle of class. You're trying to explain why you cannot make the scheduled meeting. You teach a class at another university. It is happening concurrently. Your colleague is insisting on the responsibility of your role as a thesis advisor to your student. She is raising her voice. She is using words like obligation and commitment. You can sense the tension. You can see that you are becoming the focus of this unwanted attention. Clearly, it is making your other colleagues uncomfortable. Is this discomfort about her rising voice, or is it about your willingness to accept your place in this world? You're trying to explain the challenges of your predicament. You are working two jobs you're trying to make, and just like that, you become your father. You're explaining to your foreman why you will need to leave at 3 on the dot so that you can get home in time to watch the kids while your wife takes the car to get to the midnight shift. This is no one's business but yours, you think, and yet here you are explaining your predicament. You wonder if it will always be this way for you and your children, that someone like your foreman will always insist, while someone like you will always explain. Faculty meetings. Sometimes it happens and you commit it to memory. In a faculty meeting in your first year of teaching, your older colleague says, "We need to be teaching standard English to our students. It is, after all, a marker of class." You remember that meeting, that moment, her voice, that sentence about class. For whatever the reason, you commit it to memory. Cider House Rules. You have an inventory of go-to movies that can make you cry almost instantaneously. You keep it on a shelf next to your DVD player. On the cover of each case, you've attached a strip of blue painter's tape. On it, you've written the exact time when in each movie your emotions are triggered. You're incapable of crying for anything real. Your father's funeral, the death of your student who committed suicide, the quiet in the park on that day after the day you read your friend's letter on Facebook detailing his life as a caregiver to his wife. She is dying. The letters that follow, she is dying. She died. You're denied a position inside your department. It's the third time in 12 years that you've been made a finalist and rejected. You get a call from your mother today. She tells you about your childhood friend, how he is now a millionaire. He lives in a mansion. His mother, her friend, has her own wing in this mansion. Your mother says her friend likes to brag. Your mother says, "My son is poor. He's a professor of poetry." You lose your patience. You correct your mother. You tell her to stop calling you a professor. "It's not true," you say. "You're a teacher. You're a lecturer at a school." You say they consider you as temporary, as a seasonal worker. You collect unemployment in the winters and in the summers. You are trained by your union on what to say. You say that you have no knowledge of guaranteed employment. You tell your mother that this is your life. You tell your mother to stop crying for no reason. You tell your mother to stop being the martyr. You, your mother, you are not raising your voice. You say goodbye. You tell your mother you'll call her tomorrow. You have this dream. In your dream, your brother calls you in the middle of the night. You answer, you listen, you hang up the phone, you get up out of bed, you pour yourself a drink. You don't drink, but you drink. You go into the bath of the other room. You choose a movie, The Cider House Rules. You cue it to the 1 hour and 32 minute mark. Michael Caine, as the character of Dr. Marsh, he overdoses on ether. A suicide is implied. The voiceover is a letter from informing Homer of this tragedy. Homer is played by Tobey Maguire. He is crying as he is reading this letter from home. The music cues. You're crying like a child. You wake up from your dream. And this is a poem or a story, or maybe both. But I thought about throwing away at one point, but then I had the realization that this is a poem about Wanda Coleman. And Wanda's no longer with us, and I love Wanda Coleman. So this is for Wanda. You're minding your own business, minding the business of Facebook, when you come across a writer crowdsourcing what appears to be a simple enough question. "Hi, Facebook friends. Does anybody know any good writing about anger and outrage? Already got Spinoza, thanks. Spinoza and Kendrick Lamar. I'm mad, but I ain't stressed. Thank you, crazy, lovable motherfuckers." You feel your fingers wanting to respond. You want to be seen as that guy. Yes, that. You don't want to be seen as that guy. Yes, that guy. You hear yourself saying, what the? Really? Did he really just ask? Maybe it's you. Maybe you have become overly sensitive in your old age. Maybe you need a trigger warning. The logical you insists that you acknowledge the innocuous nature of this posting. Why then did his question about writing and anger and outrage fill your words with the same anger and outrage? Is it the same? Is it because you are reminded of your friend Wanda, who left this life not too long ago? You miss her voice. The time over dinner when she said, those motherfuckers. You will always remember the rage in that whisper. Is it because writing for you is a matter of rage? You think to yourself, this is so obvious. This is not meant to be logical in the least. Is it because you were afraid of looking and then you looked and now you cannot stop looking? You are triggered by a question written in a hurry. It is perhaps not meant for you. It is a question written by a white man to other white men. Is it a matter of perspective? His and yours, it matters, it matters. He's asking a question as a matter of intellect. You're answering in this instance as a matter of necessity. Is it because you are dying to ask, what are you really asking? He pulls the trigger, not once, but five times. Is it because you live in a world where an unarmed black man running the other way is seen as dangerous and always endangered? Is it because of the way the question is written? He is trying to be poetic. He is trying to be funny. You crazy, lovable motherfuckers. Clearly, this must be striking a nerve. Did it offend your sensibilities? You tell yourself, if you can just stop looking, if you can close your eyes, maybe, just maybe, you will hear your friend whispering, those motherfuckers. Just because you've written this book, it does not mean that you can or will find it any easier to say these words out loud. You write this poem in preparation for the future, for when you will find yourself encountering an audience. Perhaps the people inside your book are sitting in this audience. Perhaps their presence will make you think twice about any attempt of reclaiming your voice. You place this poem on page 62, not quite the center, but a number you know you will never forget. You will always know where to go should you find yourself thinking that you are better off being silenced. You're born on this date, and as such, you believe that each time you read the poem on this page, you are reborn in that instant to begin again. You will tell your story. It is a familiar story. This is your story. You share it in the hopes of it becoming our story. This is our story of how, as human beings treat one another. It is an acutely cruel and human story. And this is the poem in Claudia Rankine's book that gave me permission to write this poem. Both you and your friend are reading the same book. He acknowledges its impact on him as a reader. He arrives at a poem. Your friend is saying how he saw this poem as a moment of hope. He gives his reasoning. He speaks of that moment when the poet makes herself vulnerable. She is held by the gaze of the man in the poem. She is protected by his gaze. She holds on to this moment. The moment transcends, and your friend is hopeful for having read this moment. Your friend is telling you this in his hopes to share, Both you and your friend are reading the same book. You acknowledge its impact on you as a reader. You arrive at the same poem. You're saying to your friend how you saw this poem as a familiar yet difficult moment. You give your reasoning. You speak of that moment when the narrator's voice is made aware. She is vulnerable. She is aware of his gaze. The man held his gaze. He is protecting everyone in this place, everyone that is, except for her. He is protecting them from her and her insistence in staying within his gaze. Her insistence in staying within his gaze is a way of confronting. You want to say to your friend, you're writing this poem and it is free of judgment. You want him to see what it is that you see. You want to see what it is that he sees. I'm going to end this reading with a sequence that is entitled, And Just Like That, 11/9/2016. It takes something like this to get it through my thick head that I am not accepted, that I will never be accepted in their house, at their table. I know now for what it's worth. I know now for what this is worth. I now know what I am worth. I've spent my entire adult life trying to be accepted and judged as an artist, writer, teacher by white America. Even when I thought I was standing up for myself, something was not right. It felt like a performance. I was ushered by an invisible hand to center stage, prompted to speak, to show my outrage. And so I spoke, and the white bodies, they sat quietly. They took notes. Little did I know my anger was being translated, received as minstrel. And what will I say when I am deposed? I will say that I am tired of fighting when I am not fighting to win. I am tired of fighting when I am not fighting for respect. I'm tired of fighting when I'm fighting not to be used. I'm tired of fighting when I'm tired of standing. I'm tired of fighting when the fight is to know that I can still unclench my fist. I'm tired of fighting when I'm fighting just to be seen. And just like that, the you departs, and I am left holding a bag of sand. Half full and not enough, I'm trying to fill it with all that I have, words and tears and the weight of someone else's shame. The tide is changing, the water is rising, and I have no metaphors to hold back these waves. And just like that, the unlearning of fear is unlearned this morning. I'm afraid this morning to turn on the TV. I'm afraid for the future. I'm afraid for my students. I'm afraid that my anger will keep me alive. And just like that, abstraction is a luxury I can no longer afford. It is a space to hide in shapes and colors and the labyrinth of language. Safe perhaps, but hiding is a luxury I can no longer afford. Just yesterday, I was writing a book. Today, the poem is an artifact for your children's children. Gather what's left of tomorrow's ration of white rice. Add water, blend, make it the consistency of a tactile paste. Apply it liberally to put back together what's left of your world, piece by piece. Thank you.